Judges chapter 10, please. And this morning I'd like to look at Judges chapters 10 to 16. And we'll be concerned very largely with two men, Jephthah and Samson. And once again, I'm going to assume that we're fairly familiar with these stories, particularly that of Samson, so that'll enable me to skip over a lot of the material and once again touch on what I consider to be the important features of the eras of these two judges. Now, the important section to start with is Judges 10, verses 6 to 9, because it appears to me that very likely the oppressions which are recounted here were to some extent overlapping or even concurrent. That is, Jephthah and his overthrow of the Ammonites took place at round about the same time as Samson's conflict with the Philistines, and two completely different areas of the country are involved in these two experiences, or with these two men. Judges chapter 10 verse 6, the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. They served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. And it says here also, the gods of Syria, and note these nations, the gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, and the gods of the Ammonites, and the gods of the Philistines. They forsook the Lord and did not serve him. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of the Philistines and into the hand of the Ammonites. And these Philistines and Ammonites occupied different parts of the country. We're going to find out later on that the period of Philistine domination referred to here was about 40 years, and that of Ammonite domination in another part of the country about 18 years. It goes on in verse 8 to say that these Ammonites crushed and oppressed the children of Israel that year, and for 18 years they oppressed all the people of Israel that were beyond the Jordan in the land of the Amorites, which is in Gilead. Beyond the Jordan, meaning east of Jordan. That territory on the other side of the river, which was occupied by 2.5 tribes, in contrast to Canaan itself, which was occupied by 9.5 tribes. Notice that it is the area of Gilead, which more or less is equal to the tribal area of Gad on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Verse 9, the Ammonites crossed the Jordan, that is, they crossed from east to west, and extended their influence even into the areas of Judah, Benjamin, and Ephraim. That's 3 other tribal areas on the Canaanite side, or if you like, on the western side of the Jordan River. We find that the people were distressed. They cried to God. In response to God's instructions to them, they confessed their sins, they surrendered to God, they corrected the evils which they had been guilty of, and God then promised that he would deliver them from the oppression of the Ammonites. So it's the Ammonites that we are concerned with first, and then when we come to chapter 13, we'll be concerned with the Philistines. The Ammonites had already controlled Israel for about 18 years, or that is, they controlled the areas of Israel we've just referred to. They must have sensed this feeling of uprising within Israel, and so they gathered together their forces to teach the Israelites a lesson. You find in verse 17 of chapter 10 that the Ammonites were called to arms and they encamped in Gilead, and the people of Israel came together and they encamped at Mizpah, both of these places east of the Jordan River. Verse 18, and the people, the leaders of Gilead, said one to another, who is the man that will begin to fight against the Ammonites? Who is the person that's going to lead them against the Ammonites? Although they had their armies drawn together, they had no clear leader. We're going to find now that the leader is a man called Jephthah. He belonged to the tribe of Gad, that is, he lived in the region of Gilead, and by coincidence his father's name also happened to be Gilead. But that's really beside the point for the purpose of our study here this morning. Chapter 11, verse 1. Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty warrior, but he was the son of a harlot. What happened was that because his mother was a prostitute, his brothers threw him out, and he grew up with a gang of bandits. In fact, he became the leader of a gang of bandits. Verse 2. Gilead's wife also bore him sons, that is, apart from this prostitute bearing him the son Jephthah, his wife bore him other sons. And when his wife's sons grew up, they thrust Jephthah out. They said to him, you shall not inherit in our father's house, for you're the son of another woman. And then Jephthah fled from his brothers. He dwelt in the land of Tob, and worthless fellows collected around Jephthah and went raiding with him. When they were looking for a leader, the man they decided to get to lead them was this man Jephthah. They wanted a tough character, and Jephthah was indeed a tough character. He is quite a contrast to the man Gideon that we saw previously. Gideon seems to have been a fairly kindly chap of much more gentle disposition. This man, Jephthah, had been brought up tough, and he was a bitter and uncompromising man. He reminds me very much of Jomo Kenyatta, the leader of the Mau Mau terrorists, who later became the first president of Kenya. And here we have again the leader of a gang of terrorists who turns out later on to be leader of the country. But he was not going to just be used by these people. When they came to him and said, "Jephthah, will you lead us to fight against the Amorites?" Jephthah said, "Yes, I will, provided that when I have beaten the Amorites, you won't just throw me back to where I came from. I will be your leader in battle only on the condition that after we've won the battle, I will continue to be your leader in civil administration." He drove a hard bargain, and we find that they accepted his conditions. Verse 9, Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead after they had approached him to be their leader, he said, "If you bring me home again to fight with the Ammonites, and then the Lord gives them over to me, I will then be your leader. After I've won the victory, I will be your leader in civil days as well as in battle days." And so we find now that Jephthah goes out and parleys with the Ammonites. Now the Ammonites had used the excuse that Israel had taken from it some of Ammonite territory, and they were going to take it back. Jephthah brings against them three arguments. And his main argument is this, that the area east of Jordan, which the Israelites had occupied, those 2.5 tribes east of Jordan that the Ammonites were now quarrelling over, that region, he said, had not been taken from the Ammonites. It had been taken from the Amorites. And the Amorites were the original Canaanite people. And these are the ones whom God said had to be dispossessed and exterminated by Joshua. The area had been taken from them. It had not been taken from the Ammonites or the Moabites. And the Ammonites and Moabites were brother nations who were descended from Lot, from his two incestuous relations with his daughters. So that's his first argument. Second, the land had been given to them by Jehovah, so there was no further argument. It was Israel's by right. And the third argument he brought against them was that when Israel first occupied the land, the Moabite king of the time made no objection. Why then are these people coming along later and raising these arguments? And so that really is what Jephthah has to say in verses 12 to 28. His arguing proved fruitless and war resulted. And then you find the story of Jephthah's vow. He vowed to God that if God gave them victory, he would offer as a sacrifice to God the first person who came out of his door when he arrived home after battle. It was a very foolish vow to make. But the people had been influenced by various gods, as we read, the gods of Sidon, of Moab, of Ammon. Now the god of Moab was Molech, the god of Ammon was Chemosh, and both these gods accepted human sacrifices. And you'll find these things referred to in the Old Testament, where people made human sacrifices to these gods. The offering of human sacrifices was forbidden by the Israelite law. But Jephthah knew very little of the Israelite law, and he knew nothing at all, you might say, or very little, of the character of Jehovah. He was only a very, very recently reformed bandit, and he made this foolish vow. The story goes on to say that he won the victory, and I think quite plainly from the story, he then offered his daughter as a human sacrifice. He was wrong in doing so. Nevertheless, when you come to the book of Hebrews, you find that Jephthah is commended as a man of faith. And it was through his faith in God that he won the victory. Faith, of course, is always commendable. And we must remember that it's always on the basis of our faith that God justifies us, not on the basis of our knowledge. And you only have to read the stories in the Gospels to find that very often people came to Jesus having faith, even though their knowledge was very mixed up. And a lot of them didn't seem to quite know who he was or what they were doing or what he was doing. But then the bruised reed Jesus did not break. Even those of the smallest faith he accepted, and it's always on the basis of faith, not of knowledge. And this man at least had reformed sufficiently to trust in Jehovah, even though his knowledge of Jehovah was still very deficient. So they won the victory, and you come then to chapter 12, and once again we find the people of Ephraim, the men of Ephraim, complaining. Remember how we saw before that they were the great whingers of the Old Testament period, the people of the tribe of Ephraim. Once again they complained that they had not been called to the battle. So they came from their area of Ephraim there, crossed over the River Jordan and came across into the Eastern Territory to meet Jephthah. And in verse 1 of chapter 12, the men of Ephraim were called to arms. They crossed to Zaphon, and they said to Jephthah, "Why did you cross over to fight against the Ammonites and did not call us to go with you? We will burn your house over you with fire." Now, that was a very silly thing to say to a man like Jephthah. They might have got away with a few complaints that they made to Gideon, but they couldn't address Jephthah like that and get away with it. He was a tough customer. And Jephthah responded in verse 2 with these uncompromising words. He says, "Look, you chaps, I and my people had a great feud with the Ammonites, and when I called you, you did not deliver me from their hand. So when I saw that you would not deliver me, I took my life in my hand and crossed over against the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into my hand. Why then have you come up to me this day to fight against me?" And we find that war resulted in verse 4. "Jephthah gathered all the men of Gilead and fought with Ephraim, and the men of Gilead smote Ephraim, because they," the Ephraimites, "had said, 'You are fugitives of Ephraim, you Gileadites, in the midst of Ephraim and Manasseh.' The people of Ephraim accused the people of Gad," the people of Gilead, "of running away from Israel." They accused these 2.5 tribes who had settled east of Jordan of running away from the remainder of Israel who had settled in Canaan itself. And so they made these rude comments. They said, "You're fugitives." But you find out very soon that it's the Ephraimites that are fugitives, because when the battle was joined, it was the Ephraimites who were running away, and Jephthah and his men who were winning the victory. And once again, the fords of Jordan play an important part, because Jephthah sent his men down to the Jordan River to seize the fords so that the Ephraimites could not escape. And so they picked them off as they tried to get across the Jordan River and scramble home. Verse 5, "The Gileadites took the fords of the Jordan against the Ephraimites. And when any of the fugitives of Ephraim," notice there the fugitives of Ephraim, they were calling the other people fugitives, but now they're the fugitives. "And the chickens have come home to roost, well and truly." And of course they always do. We have that story then of how the Ephraimites' accent betrayed them, and when they tried to sneak across, they couldn't. And so Jephthah kept control of Israel, and in verse 7 it tells us that he judged Israel for a further 6 years. Quite a character is Jephthah. But I want to move on now to talk about Samson. When you come over to chapter 13, we're introduced to the Philistines. Now the Philistines occupied the coastal plain, the Mediterranean coastal plain, down there in the south of Palestine, in the areas of Judah and Dan, as you see on the map there. Quite a different area from that which the Ammonites had dominated in the previous story. And as I said, it appears that these two dominations, you might say, these subjugations by these foreigners, took place more or less in the same era. And that's why they were referred to together in chapter 10, as we read right at the beginning. The man that God was going to raise up to help Israel overthrow this Philistine yoke was Samson. In verse 2, he is a man of the tribe of Dan. Now notice how Dan is one of the areas that are affected. And you notice in the story right through that the only two areas that are really concerned with this Philistine domination are the areas of Dan and Judah down there on the coast. God appeared to the parents of Samson and told them that they were going to have a son, and in verse 4 that this son was to drink no wine or strong drink, to eat nothing unclean, and no razor was to come upon his head, because he was to be a Nazarite to God from birth. The Nazarite was the person who took upon himself, or for whom somebody else took a vow on his behalf, to serve God in a certain capacity. There were three conditions attached to this vow, one of which was that he was not to cut his hair, his uncut hair apparently being a sign that he was living under the conditions of his Nazarite vow. Secondly, he was not to drink any wine, as a sign that he was denying himself the normal pleasures of life. And thirdly, he was not to touch any dead body, again, as an indication of his removal from contamination. This Nazarite vow was really a vow of separation. That's what the word Nazir mean. It has nothing to do with Nazareth. It's from the Hebrew root Nazir, meaning separate. That is, he is separated unto God for some particular job. And the job which Samson was to be separated unto God for was, as is told us at the end of verse 5, "He shall begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines." And the operative word is begin. He shall begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines. The remainder of chapter 13 tells us of how his parents had an encounter with the angel of the Lord, and finally Samson was born, and then he grew up. And in chapter 14, he has become of marriageable age, and he begins to look for ways of fulfilling his commission of doing damage to the Philistines. Verse 4, his mother and father did not know that it was from the Lord. That is, it was from the Lord that Samson wanted to marry a Philistine woman. Naturally, they had some prejudice against this, but as you read on, it was part of Samson's plan because he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. At that time, the Philistines had dominion over Israel. He thought that if he married this Philistine woman, it would give him the chance to do some damage to the enemy. Well, it certainly did give him the opportunity to do some damage to the enemy, but not quite in the way that he had planned. You see, the Israelite people as a whole had got into the mental state, the mental attitude where they felt that it was easier to live with Philistine domination than to try to overthrow it. Samson had other ideas. But the story as it goes on doesn't always reflect a lot of credit upon Samson. And the whole story really is a terrible portrayal of the evil of revenge. There are about 8 steps in this revenge, and then the other person gets square, because when he gets square he does a bit more than the previous had done to him, and so the first person gets square back again and does a bit more. Then the other person retaliates, and so you get retaliation going backwards and forwards, because each time a person retaliates, he tends to do more to the other person than was first done to him. And that's one reason why as Christians we are told that we are not to retaliate. We are to turn the other cheek. We are to be prepared to forgive, and we are to acknowledge that vengeance belongs to God and he will repay. We are not to take the law into our own hands. And here I think in this story we have portrayed for us an example of the terrible trouble which can result from this vindictiveness and revenge, and how very often the innocent are harmed as well as the person who's involved. Well, you know that Samson had this wedding feast. At the wedding feast he had a bet with the Philistines over a certain riddle. He lost his bet because his wife betrayed him to the Philistines. Whereupon Samson went out and killed 30 Philistine men. He got his revenge that way, because the bet was that the winner would give the other 30 sets of festal garments. Well, seeing Samson had lost the bet, he went out and killed 30 Philistine men and stripped them of their garments, and that was one way of getting his garments to hand over to the person who won the bet against him. That brings us to the end of chapter 14. But because he had killed 30 of the Philistine people and returned home in a huff, his father-in-law thought that Samson wasn't going on with the marriage, and so his father-in-law gave Samson's wife to another man in chapter 15, verse 2. He said, "I really thought you hated her, and so I've given her to someone else." This made Samson even more furious, and so you find then that he goes and burns down the Philistines' fields. And you can see how it's spreading beyond just the particular household that's involved in the skirmish. Then you have the story of how he tied the fire brands onto the foxes' tails and set them in among the Philistines' fields. Well, now the Philistines retaliated. This destruction had come upon them because of Samson's wife and father-in-law and what they had done. So they respond then by coming up in verse 6. Towards the end of verse 6, the Philistines burnt both the woman and her father. Well, this made Samson even madder than he was before. So he then takes revenge on them again, in verse 8, by going out and slaughtering a whole lot more Philistines. Well, the Philistines aren't going to sit still and let this happen, so you find that what they do then is to plan to get back at Samson. They go in verse 9, and they come into part of the area of Judah where Samson was, and in verse 10, the men of Judah said, "Why have you come up against us?" And they said, "We have come up to bind Samson and to do to him as he did to us." Verse 11, then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock of Etam and said to Samson, "Do you not know that the Philistines are rulers over us? What then is this that you have done to us?" And Samson said to them, "Well, as they did to me, so I've done to them." And so you see both sides are spelling it out. It's tit for tat, getting square with each other. But the really devastating verse is that one, verse 11. The men of Judah say to Samson, "Don't you know that the Philistines are rulers over us? What do you mean by rocking the boat?" They were quite prepared to just go along with the evil rule instead of trying to resist it. What a terrible temptation that is before people. They know that there's evil, but they know that if they speak up against evil, it will create problems for themselves. So rather than oppose what is wrong, they will go along with it. And that temptation faces us all, because many of us don't like controversy, and we'd much rather not be bothered. And so rather than oppose things that are evil, we keep quiet. And this is exactly what these despicable people of Judah were doing. There was one of the Israelites prepared to take steps to overthrow the Philistine yoke, and they rebuked him for it. They said, far better just to knuckle under and to submit and to keep ourselves free of bother, and in this way we'll get on all right. Well, Samson wasn't like that, and he was going to carry the fight to the Philistines. And so you find that they attacked the town where Samson was staying, but they weren't successful. And in response, verse 15, Samson then killed 1,000 of the Philistines with this jawbone of an ass that he had seized. Well, this sort of thing went on in verse 20 for about 20 years. Samson's judgeship of Israel is quite different from those that we have looked at previously. He doesn't seem to have been a great military deliverer. He doesn't seem to have led the people as some sort of general. Nor does he appear to have been any sort of civil administrator such as Deborah was. His deliverances consisted mainly in single-handed exploits against the enemy, and they were confined to those areas of Dan and Judah which the Philistines had overrun. He began the task of overthrowing the Philistines. Remember what we read in chapter 13, verse 5, he shall begin to deliver Israel from the Philistines. And that's what he was doing. With these one-man adventures, he was unsettling the enemy, and it was the first time anybody in Israel had been prepared to stand up and do something. He began the process, which ultimately resulted in the Philistines being driven out. But it took a long time, and he had no helpers whatever. It was a one-man battle that he was carrying on. So you come to chapter 16, and here we find Samson again involved with women. He certainly seems to have had something of a weakness when it comes to women. We have first of all the story of Samson going to the prostitute in Gaza, and then we have the story of Delilah, the woman who deceived him, and we know the story very well. The significant part comes in verse 17, when at last he tells her the secret, and he says, "A razor has never come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I be shaved, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man." And we know that he was shaved, and he woke up and thought that he could do as he had done before. But verse 20, the last part of verse 20, tells us he did not know that the Lord had left him. Samson never seems to have paid much heed to the requirements laid upon him by his Nazarite vow. On a number of occasions we find that he was interfering with dead bodies, the carcass of a lion in one instance, the carcass of an ass in another. I doubt very much if he adhered to the abstention from wine that was required of him, because you find him frequently joining in these Philistine revelries and feasts. But at least he had always maintained his uncut hair. But when the last symbol of his separation to God was removed, he was, in fact, separated from God. And those dreadful words, "He didn't know that the Lord had departed from him." We know what happened. He was captured, his eyes were gouged out, and there he was thrown in prison. But time passed by, and we then have the story of the feast, when they brought Samson out to make sport of him before all the lords of the Philistines. Now, in the very first of these talks, I mentioned that there were five lords of the Philistines. They were the leaders of the five cities of the Philistines down there on the Mediterranean coastal plain. You'll find them referred to in verse 23. The lords of the Philistines gathered to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon their god and to rejoice. It was a great feast. And so all the top brass of the Philistines were assembled. Those lords of the Philistines, if you go back in chapter 16 to verse 5, you'll find them mentioned there. You look at verse 27, or verse 18 rather, you'll find them mentioned there again, where Delilah consults them, and you'll find them mentioned again in verse 27 as well as verse 23. These lords of the Philistines. As the story moves on, in verse 28, Samson prayed to God. And here you see again something of the power of prayer. Samson called to the Lord and said, "O Lord God, remember me, I pray thee, and strengthen me, I pray thee, only this once." that I may be avenged upon the Philistines for my two eyes, or for one of my two eyes. And we know that he pulled the building down, and in verse 30 he said, let me die with the Philistines. Then he bowed with all his might, and the house fell upon the lords and upon all the people that were in it, so the dead whom he slew at his death were more than those whom he had slain during his life. He got the five lords of the Philistines. That was a blow which really sent the Philistines reeling. And from that point on, the Israelites began in earnest to fight against the Philistines and to seek to overthrow this yoke, because losing their five leaders all at once was a crippling blow to the Philistine administration. And from here on, you find now in the next judgeship, which was Eli, and then in the judgeship which followed, which was Samuel's, the Israelites do fight against the Philistines. And then you come to the time of Saul, and many battles are recounted. And then you come to the time of David, and finally they won the victory over the Philistines. This man Samson, from the day of his birth, from before his birth rather, of him it was said, he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines. And the whole of this story tells us how he began. And it was not without difficulty that he did it, as we've seen. But eventually Israel won the victory of the Philistines because one man was prepared to stand out and to begin a thankless task. And it's not easy to be the first one to stand up, to go against the crowd, and to suggest that these evils have to be overthrown. It did not make him popular. The people were complacent and were prepared to accept this foreign dominion rather than to fight for the freedom which they, as God's people, had given to them by the Lord Jehovah. And are we prepared sometimes to be different, to rock the boat, to stand up for God rather than to go along with the multitude? Are we frightened of rocking the boat for the sake of what is right? Or are we simply going to go along with wrongdoing because it's easier for us? It is never easy to be the lone voice. Nobody wants to be branded as a stirrer. But sometimes we have to be prepared to stand up and be counted if we are going to fulfill the work which God wants us to do.